Welcome to Christchurch Manchester Sermon Podcast.
We are one church that meets in various locations across Greater Manchester.
For more information about who we are and where we meet, please visit
www.christchurchmanchester.com.
I don't know where you were last year, May the 6th. It was quite a significant day in UK history. It was the day that Prince Charles became King Charles. I don't know if you watched his coronation on the TV. 20.4 million of us did that. One in three of the whole population of Britain sat in front of a TV to watch his coronation. It took place in Westminster Abbey, preceded over by the Right Royal Archbishop of Canterbury. The plans were massive. It was given a special code name by the police, Operation Golden Orb. There was an official coronation logo that had been designed by the former Apple designer Jonny Ive. There were 2,200 guests crammed into Westminster Abbey, not dissimilar to what we're experiencing at the back there. Foreign monarchs were in attendance, political figures and politicians, dignitaries and diplomats, A to Z level celebrities. Ant and Dec were there, Dame Judi Dench, Lionel Richie, Katy Perry, Stephen Fry and Mr. Bean. There was a procession that was 7 kilometres long. 4,000 members of the armed forces took place, 19 bands and flag wavers, which, by the way, is an abomination. They formed into 8 groups on the road. Hundreds of thousands of people lined the streets from all over the world. King Charles rode aboard a horse-drawn carriage, a stagecoach that was to be estimated in value to be £3.5 million. The king was crowned with a solid golden 17th century St. Edward's crown. The crown is £5 of solid gold set with 444 precious and semi-precious stones with an estimated value of £57 million. The king was handed the royal orb. The orb is 30 centimetres wide. It's hollow and made of beautiful fine gold, mounted with 9 emeralds, 18 rubies, 9 sapphires, 365 diamonds, 375 pearls, 1 amethyst, and a single piece of glass. I don't know what went wrong there. The king was handed the royal scepter. It weighs £3, a rod of solid gold embedded with 333 diamonds, 31 rubies, 15 emeralds, 7 sapphires, and more precious gemstones. The most precious of the gemstones is the largest light-cut diamond in the world. It has a name. It is the Cullinan One. Its value alone is £400 million. The king had personally chosen the music for the ceremony, which included 12 newly commissioned pieces of music, one of which was from Sir Andrew Lloyd Webber himself. There was a spectacular 6-minute flypast involving more than 60 aircraft from the Army, Royal Navy and Royal Air Force. The coronation, after it was completed, was followed by a concert and a laser show at Windsor Castle. The total value, $100 million. Pounds. We're in the UK. Amazing. Crazy. Oh, the contrast. Zechariah 9:9. Rejoice greatly, O daughter Zion. Sing aloud, O daughters of Jerusalem. Behold, our king is coming to you. Righteous and having salvation is he. Humble and mounted on a donkey, a colt, the foal of a donkey. Behold your king. Behold your king is coming to you. Just days before Good Friday, the day we celebrate today, Jesus has made an 18-mile journey from Jericho to Jerusalem. And just 2 miles out, a small set of towns called Bethany and Bethage, he sent some of his disciples, 2 of them, on a bit of a journey mission. Go get me a ride that I can ride into Jerusalem on. He tells them to go and get a donkey, and they have no permission to do so, but his authority. And they go find the donkey. They find it in the place that he said, and they take off their outer garments, and they lay it on the back of the donkey. And them and the disciples help Jesus to board. And then they begin the precious journey in. And it's almost as if the crowd begin to realize that this is a special moment. And they too begin to take off their outer garments and they lay it on the road before Christ as he mounts the donkey and rides into the city. And they crest over the Mount of Olives. And they, for the first time, see Jerusalem. And something incredible begins to happen. A song breaks out. And I've got no idea who begins to sing first. Maybe it just happened spontaneously. Maybe a disciple was brave enough to open his mouth and begin to sing. But what happens is the crowd begin to join him. The crowd begin to praise God for all the miracles that they've seen. And it's like the dam bursts and praise erupts. I wonder if on the journey to Jericho, the crowd, which by now is in the thousands, has begun to whisper about the things that they've seen and they've heard. Were you there when he fed the 5,000? Were you there when he walked on water? Did you hear about the blind man? Did you hear about the centurion's daughter? Did you hear about Lazarus? Just the other day he was dead and then he raised to life. And you imagine that they begin to gossip and the noise and excitement about all that God has done through Jesus. And praise erupts. And maybe as they see the city, they begin to anticipate what is to come. And contagious praise breaks out, and they sing. They sing, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord." They take an ancient psalm, Psalms 118, verse 2, which says, "Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord." But they give it a remix. They change up the words. They add in the word king because this is the coronation of Christ. And they sing, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. Behold your King." And he rides upon a donkey. But on arrival to Jerusalem, he doesn't head where a king should head, to the palace. He heads to the temple. And there the king doesn't demand love, he demonstrates love. The king doesn't command, he comforts. The king is not a tyrant, he teaches. The king does not make dictation, he educates. He's not waited on, he washes feet. He isn't served, he is the servant king. But the authorities don't hail him, they hate him. They don't love him, they loathe him. They don't want him exalted, they want him assaulted. They don't want to show him devotion, they want him dead. And so Jesus, as he prayed, is betrayed. As he's tested in the garden, he's arrested. As he's tried, he is denied, accused, abused, and now he stands bruised. John 19, then Pilate took Jesus and had him flogged. The soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head. They clothed him in a purple robe and went up to him again and again saying, "Hail, King of the Jews." And they slapped him in the face. Jesus is not worshipped. He's whipped. Pilate hopes that maybe if he can get Jesus flogged, it'll be enough so he doesn't have to kill Jesus. But the flogging alone is so brutal and so vicious. The usual instrument for the flogging, or the scouring as some people refer it to, is with this short whip made up of several different or single braided leather straps. And embedded into them are small iron balls or sharp bits of sheep bone. Tied up in intervals. Jesus would have been stripped naked, his hands tied above his head to a post, as a Roman soldier would have repeatedly struck him with such force, the iron balls would have caused deep cuts, and the leather straps with the sheep bones would have hacked into his skin and tissue. Then as the flogging continued, the cuts would have become lacerations, and they would have torn back to the skeletal muscles, to produce quivering ribbons of bleeding flesh. Jesus is whipped within an inch of his life. The scouring was called the halfway death. Some people didn't make it through. Some people didn't survive. Some people died with their hands tied to the post. Behold your king. His body is broken and bleeding. The one called the King of Kings is mocked. The Roman guards make a crown for him from thorns. They don't realize that in that moment they're making a crown that represents the sins of fallen humanity. Genesis 3:18 talks about thorns being a product of the fall. Jesus is crowned with sin itself. King Jesus, who was found innocent but yet has to endure. He's found pure but yet he is punished. They dress him in this purple robe, but they don't realize that he's robed in righteousness. They place a scepter in his hand, but they don't realize that in his hand is our salvation. They sing, "Hail, King of the Jews," as they punch him in the face. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was on him, and by his wounds we are healed. Given a chance to save Jesus, the Jews cried, "Crucify him." Pilate brings Jesus out for one final time, and he says, "Behold your king." Here he is, humiliated and hurting, distressed and now dressed as your king, bleeding and broken. The king who comes in all compassion is shown no compassion. The king who comes as love incarnate receives nothing but hatred. But they shouted, take him away, crucify him. "Shall I crucify your king?" Pilate asked. "We have no king but Caesar," the chief priests answered. Finally, Pilate handed him over to them to be crucified. Our king carries his cross through the streets of Jerusalem. The road isn't sure, and the road isn't straight. The intention of the Romans was to breed fear and control, and so Jesus is taken through narrow streets past many houses. Jesus at this point is critically injured. He's losing blood and his strength is fading. Isaiah the prophesied this. His appearance was so disfigured beyond that of any human being, and his form marred beyond human likeness. He walks for almost a mile to Calvary, to Golgotha, to the place of the skull, and there nailed to a cross. The Most High brought low, the glorious made inglorious, the powerful made powerless, the holy made unholy, the just facing injustice, the author of life left lifeless, the rescuer who would not be rescued, robed in righteousness yet hangs naked, the one who sanctified is crucified. Behold your king. Jesus is crucified between two criminals to humiliate him further. But for us, it's a reminder of his purpose. Jesus came to seek and to save the lost. And now he is crucified with them, and he is crucified for them. Above his head, above the head of those crucified, would have been written the crime for which they were being executed. Pilate had a notice prepared and fastened to the cross. It read, "Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews." The crime of Christ is clear. He is crucified for being king. Written in Aramaic, the language of the Jews. Written in Greek, the language of the people. Written in Latin, the official language of the Roman Empire. Written so all could see. Written so all would know. Written so all would understand that Jesus Christ is the king. And the Jews are fuming. The Jews are angry, and they want an edit, and they want a rewrite. The chief priests of the Jews protested to Pilate, "Do not write, King of the Jews, but that this man claimed to be king of the Jews. Pilate answered, I've written what I have written. Pilate makes no edit. Neither should we. Jesus is king. One of the famous Roman statesmen is a guy called, I can't even pronounce it, so I'm going to move on. He said, when describing the crucifixion, that it was the most cruel and disgusting penalty. It's so painful that we have a word that comes directly from the cross, the word excruciating. It comes from the Latin version. It means out of or from the cross. There is no more painful a moment, no more painful a death. And the temptation on Good Friday is for me to read out a description of his torture and his agony, to detail the pain and the shame, because we want to feel it. We want to be moved by it. We want to be saddened by it, and so that our hearts will be turned into gratitude and thanksgiving for Jesus. But the gospel writers make no reference of it. Some say that everybody knew about the pain of crucifixion, so we didn't need the details. They could spare us of those moments. Some say it was so shameful that to write it down would be to bear shame upon Christ somehow, like he wasn't carrying enough shame in that moment. But I wonder, though, if the writers wanted to draw our attention to what Jesus was achieving on the cross, for us to see past the pain to the purpose. See, John's account is beautifully unique. John is the only one of the gospel writers with a first-hand experience. John writes as an eyewitness. John is stood at the foot of the cross with Mary, the mother of Jesus. He looks up at the crucified Christ in his moment of suffering. Jesus, battling for breath and fighting the pain, speaks to him. Imagine that. Near the cross of Jesus stood his mother's sister, Mary, the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. When Jesus saw his mother there and the disciples whom he loved standing nearby, he said to her, "Woman, here is your son." And to the disciple, "Here is your mother." From that time on, the disciple took her into his home. King Jesus, fighting for breath, reconciles family in his death, finding a home for his mother and finding a mother for his friend. It's so incredibly powerful, so wonderful. Jesus is leaving his earthly family to re-enter the heavenly one. And Jesus is headed back to his Father, intending to reconcile us into his family, his heavenly family. His death restores us to God. Verse 28. Later, knowing that everything had now been finished, and so that scripture would be fulfilled, Jesus said, "I am thirsty." A jar of wine vinegar was there, so they soaked a sponge in it, and they put a sponge on a stalk of the hyssop plant and lifted it to Jesus. Knowing the end was near, knowing that his work was done, knowing that he lived righteously and now was dying for the sins of the world, Jesus asked for a drink. So strange. Knowing that he was at the point of death, he asks for a drink. Why? To somehow prolong the agony? Why bother? Was this to extend life in some way? Some last few minutes, maybe, to experience the world? Maybe there's some small hope of a heavenly rescue? No, it's none of those. Jesus takes his final drink. Jesus uses some of his final words in order to wet his lips. Jesus, King Jesus, takes one final drink to enable him to speak one final time and to use his last words for us, and they are essential. When he'd received the drink, Jesus said, "It is finished." With that, he bowed his head and gave up his spirit. He needs to utter one final sentence, three final words. He lifts his broken body one final time to speak, "It is finished." These are not the words of a man defeated. These are the words of a victor, not a victim. The old law is completed. The prophecies have been fulfilled. Obedience concluded. Love accomplished. Atonement achieved. Redemption attained. Salvation won. Sin overcome. Death defeated. It is finished. Nothing more to do. Nothing left undone. The job is done, and I need to hear his words. Can you hear them? Theologian Matthew Henry wrote, "Come and see the victory of the cross. Christ's wounds are thy healing, his agonies thy repose, his conflicts thy conquests, his groans thy songs, his pains thine ease, his shame thy glory, his death thy life, his suffering thy salvation. Behold your king." Is he your king? Or do you just believe as a man who claimed once to be king? We now move to a time of communion to remember the king. You're going to receive a small glass of red juice. And as you wet your lips, remember Jesus upon the cross, who took one final drink to speak his final words, to wet his lips and speak over us that it is finished. Today we remember his death. Today as we take bread and we take wine, we remember his death. We remember his blood shed, not into small plastic cups, but onto barren ground, to a hill called the skull. We remember his body broken by whipping and by the cross. We remember Christ Jesus, who finished his job.
Thanks for listening. To explore this sermon or learn more about our church, please navigate to the links provided in this podcast description.
From there, you can connect with us on social media, and you're welcome to check out the music links featured in this episode
from our very own musicians. You can also discover current events and information about where we meet on Sundays and various groups or community projects that you can join in with.
If you're interested in knowing more about us or wish to join us for one of our meetings, please reach out.
Simply drop us an email at hello@ccm.org.uk.
We look forward to connecting with you.
You are good, I follow you. You're so good.